G3. The Model of Being and Its Universal Laws. Number 16A.
Well, I said there is another question I would like to touch upon, which today fascinates the thinkers and perhaps also fascinates everybody and has always fascinated everybody, looking into the cosmos and seeing a terrific sense of order. Well, the stars and the planets, they have no intelligence to keep order. The intelligence is not in matter, is not in the planets, and yet there is order. These orders, as we have seen, are phenomena of the forces of the divine mind that keep really harmony and order in the whole universe. And so I reiterate that sentence again that I have read before, and then I want to put or accentuate the point of balance and equipoise. We remember that Mrs. Eddy said that really adhesion, cohesion, attractions are properties of mind, that they belong to the divine principle. Therefore, she puts them right back on a higher level and says above the material universe, there is a universe of the divine principle. And that these forces support the equipoise, the balance of thought force which launched the earth in its orbit and said to the proud wave, thus far and no farther. So we see a great equipoise in the universe, and that has been a great riddle for the modern physicist, because on the basis of the Big Bang theory, they had to consider two contrary forces. The one force that was expanding and expanding and expanding the universe and still is going on to expand. On the other side, the gravitational force that works in the very opposite direction, that gravitational force which wants to draw the universe back to its origin, so that something we're thinking, well, from one point on the gravitational force will have the upper hand, and then the universe will contract and fall back to its first Big Bang, and then everything is over. It may take a few billion years, but that was the theory that for a long time was puzzling the physicists, so that there would be no equipoise, that there would be just an expansion and afterwards a catastrophe, a contraction into a catastrophe. Whereas recently, only about 8 years ago, a nuclear physicist here in America, a very young nuclear physicist called Guth, G-U-T-H, suddenly found a very simple formula. So simple that it must be true, because in physics, every formula that is simple has always the ring of truth. The moment the formula is very complicated and goes over half a page and pages, one can think that there is something fishy about it. That's not quite true. Because reality is built on symmetry, and the symmetry is a very simple equation. So he suddenly, by thinking about all these things, found the mathematical answer, and that is very interesting in regard to what Mrs. Eddy says about that equipoise, that balance that exists between two apparently contradictory forces, the forces of expansion and the forces of contraction. How do they play together? And he said, among others, he said, the universe is balanced with incredible precision between runaway expansion, that would be the expanding sense, and second, the catastrophic collapse. The catastrophic collapse, that would be the gravitational forces that draws everything back to the Big Bang, just as we have it in the black holes. And he said, there is an incredible balance existing. The universe, he says, has expanded far faster, yet it was the gentlest of events. You see, expansion is naturally change. And change usually brings a crisis, brings a catastrophe, anyway, a crisis. But he says it was the gentlest of events against the theory of expansion and collapse dilemma. So up to that point, there was that dilemma, will the universe constantly expand so that the expansion forces have the upper hand, or will the gravitational, the contraction forces have the upper hand, and then there will be another catastrophe, everything will fall into bits together to the beginning of the Big Bang. And he said, no, there exists somehow an intelligence that keeps those two apparently contradictory forces, or forces that act in the very opposite way, in a complete balance. And he says, this balance is so incredibly exact that he compares and says that expansion of the universe goes on comparable to balancing on the edge of a knife, a pencil on its point, through 15 billion years. So that is symbolism. We know how difficult it would be to balance a pencil on its point on a edge of a knife only for a fraction of a second. And he says, there is an intelligence at work, a law at work, that balances absolutely in equipoise through all those up to now 15 or 20 billion years since the Big Bang. Well, what kind of intelligence can there be at work that can really hold something in balance? And that's why Mrs. Eddy talks about that equipoise. See, she doesn't use that term very often. I think she only uses it once or twice, perhaps, and that in that sixth chapter, in order to really show that it really is divine mind that is the only power, and that therefore that power has within itself that intelligence. Mind is the universal intelligence. Within itself, that universal intelligence that can even keep the material universe as we experience it, as material, in such balance, in such equipoise, that there is only harmony and order. Therefore, order out of chaos. Mrs. Eddy uses another term in the sixth chapter to bring out that equipoise. And it is a sentence that has always puzzled the Christian Scientist. I remember that this sentence has been of great concern. Even teachers have asked me, Christian Science teachers have asked me what I think, what Mrs. Eddy said, meant with the term equipollence. And I too couldn't really answer. I didn't quite know. It was also flimsy in my consciousness. And now we begin to realize what she was saying. And naturally, she was showing that equipoise on a higher level, as as the equipollence of God. The sentence that she has written in the sixth chapter is that she says, the equipollence of God brought to light another glorious proposition, man's perfectibility and the establishment of the kingdom of heaven on earth, not in heaven, but on earth. So that term equipollence is a word that is not well known in the common language. Equipollence means it's equality of power, or in other connotation, it's equality of force, or in another connotation, it means equality of significance. Now, if we take that and see what does Mrs. Eddy understand under the equipollence on a higher level, on the level of divine science, then she explains it as the following, that she explains that the equipollence is that there is an equation, so to say, an equality, that's an equation mathematically, of saying God is all, or you could say with the same value, sin, sickness, and death are unreal. Can you see? This is the equipollence. Those two apparently two different significations, God on one side and sin, sickness, and death as the very opposite on the other side, as two great opposite concepts or power or forces, Mrs. Eddy puts into an equation and says, I give you the equation. On the one side of the equation stands God is all, and that means the same thing, has the same significance as saying sin, sickness, and death are not. That's the equipollence. Or we can say, on the one side of the equation is that God is the only power, and on the other side, sin, sickness, and death have no power. There are two different phrases that from outside don't look alike, but in its significance, they have equality. It's equality. And this is, I think, the key concept that Mrs. Eddy gives in that sixth chapter. Don't get cross at me if I constantly go back to the sixth chapter. It is actually so that that sixth chapter just seems to give, as the only chapter, really the answer, what is Mrs. Eddy's sense of science? What is her sense of science? Not in a religious way, not so much in a saving way, but what are the scientific criteria of what Mrs. Eddy calls science, with capital S. So here she gives the equipollence of the allness of God and the nothingness of evil. That is the equipollence, which says whatever or however God, good, translates itself on any level of experience, it will always be good, and evil forces will not be able to accomplish anything. So that there is in the world a constant balance of God. But not only does she say this is an equipollence, but she says this reveals something, namely man's perfectibility. Why should man have the possibility to perfect himself instead that man has the possibility to degrade himself constantly and constantly until he gets back to be a real animal again? Is the evolution going on out of chaos into order because of this equipollence of God? We find here, with this sentence, the answer of what I was trying to show at the end of yesterday, in the last hour, that there is an equipollence in obstetrics. You can have a material obstetrics, you also can have a scientific obstetrics, but scientific obstetrics will be the real, and material obstetrics will be the unreal. And because scientific obstetrics is the real, we can be sure that there will be a spiritual birth going on, and that nothing on earth can kill that child when it is born. There is no possibility of a biological, medical, or physiological birth going on. And so with any other science we can see, it is always saying that, so to say, that the reality of God good, the reality of God good, is at the same time the reality that evil is unreal. It's always reality. So we can look at reality from both sides and say there is only one reality of God good, but also the reality that evil is not real. Then you only have a oneness. You solve your question of duality and of the question where evil comes from. There is only one thing always there. So in a way we could formulate it and say, well, the reality of God good is equal to another reality. Which other reality? The reality that evil is unreal. That's also a reality. The nothingness of evil is real, is true. You can put it with truth. You can say, well, the truth of God good is also the truth that evil is untrue. That's also a truth. So you have only truth. Can you see we have constantly a possibility of putting a subject as the object of investigation and then look at it from two vantage points, but never lose the object of investigation. So if we investigate God good as infinite good, we can have the equipollence that the power of the reality of good is the same power of reality that says evil has no power. That's the same thing. And so on this basis, you begin to realize that we are living in a material universe, but that material universe is universe. And therefore, there is a spiritual universe. And the reality of the spiritual universe shows really that the material universe is unreal, is only an imitation, a simulation, a counterfeit. That's why Mrs. Eddy then has this interesting short statement that she would say that what are termed laws of nature, if we are not reading further, we think, well, the laws of nature are actually material laws, they are false laws. But she says, what are termed laws of nature appertain to spirit, not to matter. They appertain to spirit. But she's very careful in her language. She says, what are termed? She could have said, what we have termed laws of nature. We term them laws of nature, but actually they are not laws of nature. They are actually laws of spirit. So all these laws of attraction, cohesion, and so on, all those laws of forces are actually forces of the divine mind. And only if we don't see them as divine mind, we see them in a simulated way, in a counterfeit way, and then we distort those forces and we have the material forces. So she says, laws of nature are laws of spirit. If we look into the world and we see nature and we see the laws of the universe and put them into mathematical laws, we should know that they are not laws of matter, but laws of spirit, rightly seen. But that is only right if we don't have a one-dimensional way of thinking. There they would not be right. But if we have a vertical consciousness that can translate constantly from a higher level to a lower level, then these statements are right. That makes sense. Because the laws of spirit always translate themselves to every level, even to the level of our human experience, and therefore are in this universe, in this one universe of many universes, the laws of nature. So she says, the laws of matter are erroneously called laws of nature. They are only called that way. They are not. They are only called, we only attribute really something to the laws of spirit, something which we attribute, and that what we attribute is always wrong. We erroneously attribute it as laws of nature, as laws of matter. And so we get really to the oneness of spirit again. That is what I would have liked to share with you about the Big Bang. It may be, I want to be very cautious, it may be that after 10 or 20 years when we listen to these tapes, that perhaps we see something more clearly, more definitely, more exactly, more scientifically, but somehow we have to start somewhere with a new insight and probe it and feel our way with it. But it is much better than always to leave a whole subject like those that page 124 to 125, so to say, in distance, and say that I don't touch, put them under the carpet, I dish them under the carpet, I wipe them under the carpet. I got it finally. Weep. Yeah. So we have taken it from under the carpet and have said, let's have courage to look at it from what we have seen from the point of view of a holistic science with its dimensional sense. Yes, that's it. That finishes our introduction that we have considered in order to understand now much better the chart. In earlier years, say long ago, 1972 and then 73, I was talking quite a lot about the chart itself, about the dimensions, the laws of interdependence, and I still would say they are still holding good, but we were just always going right into the chart, and this year I felt, yes, I would like to talk about the chart, about the model of being, but I felt that perhaps something is necessary, namely, first to give the nest in which to put that chart, just first to give a sense of what consists a holistic science. If we take that chart, now I'm going to this chart here. From this moment on, most of you have it in their mind, but perhaps you have it right in front of you for the rest of the week, because I'm going to talk about this model of being. Looking at it from the point of view of the holistic science, we can really see that everything that concerns a holistic science is incorporated within that one little chart. It is therefore a very great reduction of the infinite one to one page or to a model that can be symbolized on one single page. This is naturally a great reduction, and therefore if we understand the inner relationship of that chart, we really have on one page the infinite. It's only a question that we know how to handle this chart, how to interpret this chart, and then we can, with it, explore the infinite. It is therefore a great rationalization of a subject, a great economy of the subject. If we can put the infinite into one page, it's a great economy. And that has always touched me when I read in the textbook that she said, both science and consciousness. Well, science explains really the object of reality. Consciousness depicts the way how we look through the lens in order to see reality. So there are those two things, the object and the subject, that they should be one. So she says, both science and consciousness are now at work in the economy of being. Apparently, this chart is the highest economy of being that we really can think of. And that economy of being works according to the law of mind, which ultimately asserts its absolute supremacy. So that this would indicate that if we understand this economy, that we will have a supreme standpoint. I think I have to stop here.